Good afternoon, everyone. We're really happy to have folks here so close to Thanksgiving. I know people are eager to get out and start cooking, but I think this is a really great opportunity to hear from TK Logan, who's done some really interesting and important work documenting the importance and impact of civil protective orders. So, TK, I'm just going to, you know, briefly introduce you, but feel free to add on. TK is a professor in the Department of Behavioral Science at the College of Medicine at the University of Kentucky, and she's been researching violence on against women for the past 15 years and has authored approximately 100 articles, or I'm sure more by this point. So with that, I guess we don't want to take too much time because I know you have a lot to share and we want to leave plenty of time for questions. I will
absolutely
turn it over to TK.
Okay. Hello, everybody. Glad to be here. And this is a little bit awkward. I usually do this more interactively, and I'm not sure all the animation is going to work right, so we're just going to go with the flow on this. So, with surprises probably along the way. Also, I do talk pretty fast, and it's harder to gauge what I'm saying or what isn't clear. So if you have questions, go ahead and put them up, and I'll try to respond to them, or I think maybe somebody can help, if I'm not responding, help, you know, interrupt or whatever so that I'm clear. What, you know, I have titled this is Civil Protective Orders, Justice, or Just a Piece of Paper, and I always like to start out by saying, you know, my goal in my career was not to start out saying I'm going to evaluate protective orders. In fact, I thought the opposite. I thought that my first grant that I wrote that was funded by the federal government, I thought what I would do was look at 2 years before the protective order of women who were abused, and then after women got a protective order, I would look at what kinds of things happened to them after the abuse stopped. So for me, it was, I felt like protective orders worked. It wasn't really a question. And after that study got funded, I went out to the community and started talking to people before I implemented that study and actually got a lot of different kind of input into how they thought protective orders work. So obviously victim services were first, they're the first agencies I went to and talked to about the study because as a community researcher, it's really important to me to go into all the communities that I wanted to recruit women out of and work with the victim service agencies. And, of course, they said to me, well, protective orders are just a piece of paper. Our second big group that we had to get on board was obviously the judges because what we were doing in that study, which we replicated in the study I'm going to talk about today, was we recruited women out of court at the point at which they received a more permanent order, what in Kentucky we call a DVO, and I'll talk about that process here in a little bit. But so we were guests in the courtroom, and so we had to get the judges on board with the study and get their opinions, and their opinions of protective orders were pretty negative. Women were always dropping, and women lie. And when you look at the media, you know, always see pretty much stories about the ultimate failure of a protective order, a murder. And then when I went to the research, what I found is between 20% and 70% of protective orders are violated, which really I did not find helpful at all. Meanwhile, we were interviewing, I can't see this piece, it's not working, but we were interviewing over 750 women that we did recruit out of court at 5 different jurisdictions, 4 very rural, eastern Kentucky, Appalachia rural, and 1 urban, and we followed them 12 months later, and none of these perspectives were really lining up with what we were hearing from the women. So based on that, we went back to the National Institute of Justice and asked for some funding to do a better job of looking at protective order effectiveness. Let me just start a little bit with our process, the way it worked in Kentucky at the time we did the study. Things have changed a little bit legislatively, given a high-profile murder that we had after the study sort of was wrapping up. But at the time, we had the Emergency Protective Order, EPO. That was good for about 2 weeks. And so when that was issued and signed, then the respondent had to be served of the notice of the protective order and notice of a hearing, where both parties came in front of the judge, and the judge could grant the order, the form or permanent order, for up to 3 years. Our average in Kentucky is actually something like 2.3 months, 2 years and 3 months on average, but they can do up to 3 years. In Kentucky, we have two kinds of orders. We have a no contact and a no violent contact. So our people can actually continue to live together if they want to, and have an order in place. And in Kentucky, we don't care about dating violence, so you either have to have been married at some point or have lived with that person at some point or have had their child. So if you're dating and you're pregnant by that partner, you still would not qualify for a protective order. So you can see that about half of our people were married, about half had cohabitated, and about half had children in common. And what we did also, we recruited about 213 women. And also, let me back up a minute, all of the women in this study voluntarily sought this order. We do have a few problems with Child Protective Services trying to insist women get orders, and we did not have any women like that in our in this particular study. Like I said before, this study was multidimensional. So we had 213 women we recruited out of court at the time they got the protective order, and we followed them at 3 and 6 months, and we had a 99% follow-up rate. And we also, again, recruited half from the rural area and half from an urban area, a rural area being the eastern Kentucky Appalachian area, which is a very under-resourced area. We also interviewed over 200 key community professionals, so lots of different avenues of victim services, mental health providers, social workers, hospital workers, anyone who came in contact with victims from that avenue, as well as criminal justice system, people, judges and police and sheriffs and jail and probation and anyone. So in all of our communities, we also got that dimension. We also got extensive official court data from the Administrative Office of the Court, and we worked closely with an economist to look at cost data and estimates. Because we did such an intense analysis 6 months before the protective order and 6 months after the protective order, we used what we call a participant calendar, where we anchored each month to help respondents or of the survey, to help the interviewees, I should say, remember things like service use, when they called the police, and abuse. Although what I found out was that women have a very good memory for what the abuse that happened and when it started and when it stopped and that kind of thing. But where this was more helpful was with services. So just a little background. The victims were on average about 33 years old. The offenders were on average about 35 years old. Our sample in the rural area was mostly white, and that is consistent with, you know, representative from the rural area. Our urban area was a little more diverse, but still more white. Looking at offenders, because we had their criminal histories, we could really take a good look. And what we found is, not including that 6 months right before the DVO was issued, so I went back before that because I didn't want to count charges that may have occurred from the EPO incident or the incident that prompted her to get that EPO. But so looking before that first six-month period, we see 73% of offenders had prior charges, 11 average charges. And of those 73%, 87% had prior convictions, with an average of 7 prior convictions. And, of course, substance-related charges and convictions were very high. We also found that about 16% of the offenders had prior DVOs against other victims only in Kentucky. Of course, Kentucky is surrounded by 7 states, so we were not able to get other states' data. But we also looked at all kinds of different services the women in the study may have used the year before obtaining the protective order. And you can see that there are high rates of victim services, youth, mental health, health services, and lawyer, private attorney or a lawyer. You start to see some rural-urban differences there with more rural women reporting use of health services and lawyers. And part of that is because those communities don't have access to advocates like they do in the urban area, for one thing. And another, a lawyer, the rural women were more likely to be married and have children and that kind of thing, so it was a little more complicated for them to separate. Substance use is pretty high, you see, and that includes, we asked women if they were taking a prescription, a legitimate prescription to cope with the abuse. And one of the things I was really interested in is looking at it change over time in that particular measure after the protective order. And that also includes, though, alcohol and illegal drug use. And you can see use of police the year before is very high. And, of course, friends and family, which we've seen before. So when you ask that question, do protective orders work? For me, you know, it's not just one question, does it stop the violence? It's actually really pretty complicated. These are just a few of the questions that I can think of off the top of my head. So does it stop the violence? If it doesn't stop the violence, does it reduce the abuse? How does it impact coercive control, which isn't really technically a violation of the protective order? It depends on how that's carried out potentially. What about the quality of victim life? What does she think? What are the costs and cost benefits of protective orders, and how do they work different in different jurisdictions? So starting with that first question, do protective orders work? We kind of just talked about these pieces. So does it stop the violence? Does it reduce violence and abuse, and how does it impact coercive control? So what we found is, so 50% of the women said that they did not experience a violation. And of those 50%, half of those women said they never even heard from him again in that 6-month follow-up. So, and let's see, here's how we define a violation. This is actually backwards than how I would like for it to show, but it's primarily consistent with our statute violation being property damage, threats of harm, any physical violence, any use of a weapon, or, this is where it does differ a little bit from our statute, any victim report of a violation. So we are pretty broad in violation. Now what I want to do is take that 50% that experienced a violation, and I want to look at their levels of abuse, what is going on with them. So when I do that, taking the more sort of severe kind of tactics that would meet our statute, these are only women, keep in mind, that experienced a violation of the protective order. So we look at 84% of them experienced threats of harm the 6 months before, 36% after. Moderate physical, 76% before, 15% after. Severe physical, 58% before, 11% after. Rape, 21% before, 2% after. Threats or use of a weapon, about 1/3 before, 11% after. So we are seeing fewer of those women, even those who experienced a violation, who are reporting these tactics. Now what I want to do, though, is I want to take each one of those, these 36% that experienced threats to kill or harm, for example, and I want to look at the number of times they were threatened before and after. And I'm going to do that for each one of these tactics in this next slide. And so when I do that, what we're seeing is not only are fewer women experiencing each one of those tactics, but even of those experiencing those tactics in the 6 months after, they experience reductions in the number of times. You can see threats to harm or kill, moderate physical goes from 30 days the 6 months before to the 2 days in the 6 months after. Severe physical went down significantly. Of those who experienced rape, goes down. and threats or use of a weapon goes down. Then the question is, well, what about those kind of tactics that would not necessarily meet our statute in terms of a technical violation? So psychological abuse, economic, symbolic, where he's shaking a fist at her, throwing something but doesn't necessarily hit her, child interference or threats, threats about to or actual assault of others. So in each one of those tactics, again, we see a very similar pattern, reductions in the number or the percent of women from the 6 months before to the 6 months after that experienced them. And again, this is still only for women who experienced a violation. And when we look at those tactics, of those who experienced those tactics the 6 months after, we see a significant reduction in the number of times across every single one of those. And when we look at control, jealousy and control, which we know is the core of what partner violence is, you can see that, again, just for the violation group, we see a significant reduction, 90% to 54%, who experienced any jealousy and control before and after. But if we look at just that 54% that said, yeah, you know, I still experience some jealousy and control after, when you look at the number of days, you see a significant, again, relief from jealousy and control for even those who experience any of it. So now the next set of questions, yes, if you have any questions or anything, please let me know. The next question, set of questions kind of focus on, well, what do victims think about protective orders? How do they impact their fear levels, their quality of life, and how satisfied are they with the protective orders? And one of the things, remember, in the beginning that the judges were sure to school me on was how women are always dropping protective orders. So, of course, that was a really important thing for me to look at, is how many drop the order. So in looking at fear of future harm, this is at the six-month follow-up. Oh, actually, this is looking at the baseline and the six-month follow-up. We see significant drops of fear across four kinds of harm. We actually measured harm and fear across a number of dimensions, but we've kind of collapsed them into four. So physical harm and threats, harm and harassment of close others, social financial harm, and ongoing harassment and control. So you can see we have drops over time in those, as you would expect. We also see we looked at the number of days they were stressed, anxious, or depressed due to the abuse, the 6 months before and the 6 months after. We see some relief there. Trouble sleeping. We see a significant drop in the days bothered by trouble sleeping. And even days use substances to cope with the abuse. So we are seeing, again, consistent with reduced violence, some outcomes. And the vast majority of women, even those who experienced a violation, say that they were believed that protective order was effective. And only 4% dropped the order during our six-month follow-up. And that's very consistent with our prior study, which found about 9% in that 12-month follow-up had dropped the order. And I always like to make sure that women's voices are represented, and it's not just all about numbers. So these are just three women who talked about how they felt about the protective order. One said, I ended my abusive relationship after I filed for the protective order, and I've not seen or heard from him since I filed for that order. Another said the protective order was extremely effective. It got him out of my life, out of my house, and the violence stopped. And this third woman actually chose to continue to live with her partner, and she said, for the first time, he took me seriously and realized I wasn't going to put up with the abuse. The protective order successfully alerted him the abuse had to stop or there would be consequences. So now we kind of can turn some attention to, well, how much do protective orders cost us? How much does domestic violence cost us? And what's the trade-off? And we were able to, because of the calendaring and because I was able to work closely with an economist here at the University of Kentucky and take this into consideration up front, we did a very in-depth look at any health, mental health, and victim services that they use 6 months before and 6 months after. We looked really in-depth at the legal and justice system costs, police, charges, convictions, jail time, and any attorneys that were used. what I call lost opportunities, civic and family responsibilities, so daycare, caring for elderly family members, which many of these women have, just like some of us, transportation costs, and any kind of property loss that they had. And then what I call, or what we call, the health-related quality of life loss. One of the things that we noticed is when we looked at these calendars is that the physical abuse was periodic. It wasn't every single day, every single month across the 6 months, 6 months before, for example. But what was every single day, I have a question here. Let me just stop and back up. Someone asked if our protective orders address custody. Well, yes, they're designed to, but the judges are very reluctant to use that option for a number of reasons, which we can talk about at the end. So it isn't used a lot. So back to health-related quality of life, I was saying that the physical abuse tends to be periodic, but what I just saw that I just couldn't let by was this daily grinding, the degradation, the humiliation, the control over finances. And so the economists and we actually even worked with Mark Cohen on this too, which is another economist that takes into consideration victim cost of crime. And we decided to look at the cost analysis considering that. And just for example, this is an example of a calendar of what you can see, those hash marks kind of degradation that she experienced 6 months before: jealousy and control, financial, work, stalking. So just how much it impacted her. And this is her calendar 6 months after the protective order was issued. So just huge difference. But when looking at all of that, and all the details are in our report of the cost stuff, because it's complicated and I'm glossing over lots of painful details to get to this point. But meanwhile, the cost of partner violence 6 months before came to about $17,500 the 6 months before per each participant in our study. The cost of partner violence after was almost $13,000, and the cost of a protective order is about $354. Let me see. Now we see about a $4,700 reduction there per participant in our study, and that cost of a protective order, the judges participated in, of course, helping to develop the cost. It was a very painstaking, careful analysis, but when they saw how low that was, the judges tacked on every cost they could possibly come up with, and still pretty low compared to the cost of partner violence. So overall, when the economists extrapolated the data to look at the cost benefit, basically he estimated for every dollar spent on the protective order intervention, it was about $30.75 in costs from partner violence that we would have expected had there been no protective order based on that 6 months before. And when he extrapolated that data to civil protective orders issued in 2007 statewide, we did adjust 15% for male or same-sex victims. He estimated that protective orders basically cost our state, or saved our state, about $85 million. Now, we think that's an underestimate because, again, this is not, these are only for women issued protective orders in 2007, so not any before, any after. And this is another cost that you have to think about with partner violence, but we couldn't actually incorporate this into our cost assessment. But children averaged, witnessed violence an average of about 32 days, 6 months before the protective order, and 1 day in the 6 months after the protective order. So sort of a next question of that is, so who do protective orders work best for and under what circumstances? So we had the opportunity to kind of take into consideration a lot of variables that I hadn't been able and I hadn't seen taken into consideration altogether before in the literature. So for example, area, rural, urban, the age of the offender, race of the offender, his criminal justice system involvement, whether they had been married, the number of years they'd been together, the number of kids in common, and whether they spent any time back in that relationship after the protective order, because I hypothesized that if he had more access to her, so kids in common or, you know, back in the relationship, that that would increase, potentially increase the likelihood of a violation. And also violence history, physical abuse severity, sexual abuse severity, and stalking 6 months before. So our biggest predictor of violations, you know, something that sort of washed all of the others out, it was stalking. Well, now that gave me something really interesting to look at. Now, this is a very simple way of defining stalking. It does take into consideration our elements. We actually asked a lot of questions about stalking, but I just like to give sort of a quick definition. Repeated behavior that was unwanted and made her afraid or concerned about her safety. So when I looked at this, so now we have, I remind you, a no violation group, so half of the women didn't experience a violation, but half did. Of those half that did experience a violation, half of those said they were not stalked. However, half said that they were stalked. So you can see the stalking group definitely experienced also more violations. But now that gives me basically three groups. And I want to look at a number of outcomes based on these three groups, the no violation group, violations and no stalking, and then the violation and the stalking group. And when we do that, just looking at fear of future harm, this is at follow-up, we see that either there's a linear relationship across those groups, or you see that the stalking group definitely pops in terms of they're much more afraid of physical harm, harm of others, social financial harm, and ongoing control and harassment. When we look at sort of their quality of life indicators, you can see that they also suffer more days of stress, anxiety, and depression than even the group that experiencing ongoing violations but no stalking. The stalking group also has significantly more days of trouble sleeping in the 6 month follow-up, the 6 months after that protective order was issued. And again, they're still having to use substances to cope with the stress, anxiety of the abuse. So then we ask, well, how many days in the past 30 have you experienced your health was not good or your mental health was not good? And there again, we still see that stalking group suffering more days. Because I thought, well, maybe right after the protective order, he was stalking more. How long lasting are these effects? But this is the 30 days prior to our 6 month follow up. This is a CDC question that they ask for at each state, and for Kentucky, which we're pretty high, the general population of women will say 4.5 days that their health is not good, 3.5 days that their mental health isn't good. So you can see that even the women, though, who experience no violations, they're still, you know, suffering double from the general population. So just to give you a little benchmark there, but still the stalking victims are much worse off. Again, we see this across a number of different measures. We had anxiety, depression, pain that limits activity. The other thing we were able to look at is some more tangible losses by group. So we see that the stalking group lost about $100 on average each month during that 6 month follow-up versus the group that experienced ongoing violations. So for that whole 6 month period, they lost about $135 in property damage or property loss. Hours of lost time, and this was mostly work time, our stalking victims, it was about 13 hours on average each of the 6 months in that 6 month follow-up versus 18 hours total for those who experienced ongoing violations but no stalking. And remember that for every dollar spent on the protective order intervention, there's $30.75 in costs to society. You can see that, yeah, we're seeing definitely a return for the no violation group and even the ongoing violation group, but we do not see a return at all. The stalkers are basically continuing to cost the community and the victims money. And their children, not surprisingly, are also the ones continuing to witness violence, the stalking victims. Now, this I also found interesting. So although all of those outcome measures we looked at, we saw a linear relationship, or we saw even stalking victims even worse off. But when we looked at victim service use or engagement at the six-month follow-up or mental health service use or engagement, we don't see rates of stalking victims engaged at higher levels than those experiencing ongoing violations, which I thought was kind of interesting. So moving on to the next question, do they work differently in different jurisdictions, in particular rural versus urban? We know from national data that rates of partner violence don't differ greatly by rural urban. And what we found in this study, in our prior study as well, is that the civil protective order effectiveness didn't differ. Our victims' lives were improved regardless of area. It was about the same, 50% experienced a violation, 50% didn't. Stalking was still the number one predictor of violations. Overall, costs and cost benefits didn't differ. Now, within those cost categories differed, but not overall. However, well, one of the other similarities we found was that victims experienced numerous barriers to obtaining protective orders, regardless of jurisdictions, in particular three, fear of not being believed or the credibility issues, personal barriers like embarrassment and fear of not being believed, and gatekeeper discouragement. So there's a lot of issues with the police officer or the court clerk sort of being discouraging, rude, that kind of thing, when they went to initiate the EPO. However, we did find some significant differences in the experiences between rural and urban. In particular, with regard to life circumstances and system barriers. So with life circumstances, what we found is our rural women were much more entrenched in the relationship. They were more likely to have been married to the offender. They were in that relationship longer. They were more likely to have children in common, and they were more likely to be unemployed at the time that they sought the protective order. However, what we found is by the time rural women sought protective orders, more of them were done with that partner. So more of them were, they were less likely to be living with that protective order partner at the EPO incident than in the urban area. And fewer of them did get back in that relationship after the protective order was issued. And of those who did get back together, they spent less time in the relationship than those women in the urban area. When you look at fear, this is at baseline, comparing urban and rural. And you see rural women, more of them are afraid of physical harm, harm and harassment of others, social financial harm, and ongoing control. And when we look at after, you see there's significant declines in fear for both groups, but again, more rural women are afraid of each one of these fears than urban women, even at our six-month follow-up. And you can also see, this is again at follow-up, that just looking at urban and rural, rural women are suffering more days of stress, anxiety, and depression due to the abuse, trouble sleeping, and using substances to cope with the abuse. There are also significant systematic barriers. So what we found from the key informants and from the women is that they have more limited access and more runaround to obtaining protective orders. So just for example, it took the rural women about 3.5 hours to get a protected an EPO compared to about 1.5 hours for the urban women. When we asked key professionals, how out of 10 EPOs, how many in your community do you believe would turn into a DVO? The rural respondents on average said 4 versus 6 for the urban area. So there's just an acknowledgement that it is just more difficult access, and it's just more difficult to get a protective order in the rural area. Rural area, there's a lot, significant mention of sort of this good old boys and who you know matters network, that protective orders or domestic violence in general is just a lower priority crime in the rural area, whereas drugs, was a much higher priority crime, and we heard this from victim advocates as well as criminal justice respondents, much more so than in the urban area. We saw more, less knowledge and more traditional stereotypes about domestic violence in the rural areas than in the urban area, and then we saw more limited enforcement, which I will go into some more about the enforcement. I do want to reiterate, again, so the protective order effectiveness, just the protective order and the violations did not differ by area. Their lives were improved. The cost and cost benefits did not differ by area, even though we found these other barriers. So I'm going to skip a lot of that detail on the rural-urban differences and kind of move into the enforcement, which is a big issue. One of the questions we ask the key informants, and this is in particular our criminal justice informants, is if there was a difficulty in determining primary aggressor at a call for the police, how likely is it both would be arrested? And so in the urban area, the criminal justice, about 42% said, yeah, both are likely to be arrested. But in the rural area, 87% of our respondents said that. So there's a huge barrier for enforcement right there. Looking at enforcement for the EPO incident, so of the women at the EPO incident who said that they reported it to the police, 45% of the urban women said they believed he was arrested for that incident versus 18% of the rural, and 74% talked to the police about the EPO incident. Just looking at enforcement after the DVO, so this is the more permanent order. Forget about the EPO now. Now we're just going to go from that DVO forward during that 6 months. We know 50% were violated. The urban women experienced an average of 9 violations. The rural women an average of 15 violations. Of those 50% that experienced even one violation, 65% of those women, and this did not differ by rural-urban, said that they reported it to the police or to the court. Let's see. So of those 65 that reported the 65% that reported the violation, 38% of the urban women said they believed there was an arrest. And when we looked in his offender, in that offender's record, we saw 83% had some kind of domestic violence related charge. In the rural area, about 19% of the women said there was an arrest, and when we looked in those offenders' records, only 14% had an actual recorded violation or some kind of domestic violence-related charge. Just taking away her perception of whether there was an arrest because maybe she didn't know, and we just looked at those who said they reported the violation. About half of the urban women, or just over half of the urban women's of those respondents, had some kind of domestic violence-related charge versus about 6% for the rural women. This is just looking at secondary data. 5 years collapsed. This is the urban area where I took three misdemeanor-level kind of domestic violence-related charges. Assault, fourth, domestic violence is the dark green. Violation of a protective order is that middle kind of lighter green, and then on the end is a stalking second, and that's our misdemeanor stalking charge. And in the urban area, you can see that, 61 to 71% of assault, force, domestic violence, and violation of protective order end up with guilty, but you can see much fewer of the stalking charges end up with guilty, and more of them are dismissed. Now, when we look at the rural data, disposition data, we see a lot more dismissal and a lot fewer guilty for all three charges. Now, keeping in mind that stalking charges were really low in the rural area, 11 total, so there were no guilty. All right. So, now this is where I would normally do a summary and implication, and I know this has been a quick sort of overview of this big, it's a 200-page report that is out on the internet, so if anyone wants some nighttime, bedtime reading, that would be something to think about. But one of the things that I found as I have gone around the nation talking about this study is that I have kind of three reactions to this study. The first one is sort of people are blitzed, like, oh, it's a lot of data. I'm still processing, you know, kind of back on your first slide. The second response I often get is, you just told me everything I knew. I've just never really seen it all put together like this. And then the third response I get is, I don't believe it. I don't believe this. And so I've really had to put a lot of thought into, okay, what is it? What are ways people are trying to dismiss the findings? And so today I have five that I'm going to talk about. There are seven total, but these are the five main ones that people will say to me. So people will say, well, protective orders just don't work. And I say, well, I've just spent 45 minutes talking about how they stop and reduce violence and abuse for many victims and their children. They appreciate the order. They cost very little, yet save victims and society a substantial amount of money. And these findings are robust and consistent. They're very consistent with our earlier work, and frankly, they're consistent with other research. This is the way we frame. You know, we talk about violations, but you know, what I said in the beginning, you know, 20 to 70% are violated. Well, that means, you know, 80 to 30% are not violated. In a meta-analysis that was done in 2002, they found 40% of protective orders are violated. But still, they'll say to me, no, they just don't work. So I have to ask, is something wrong with your ear? But after trying to be nice about it and think, well, why are people still not buying this? I agree with that a protective order is not a silver bullet. It's not an end-all, and you certainly still have to be aware of victim safety. I think sometimes it's hard to give up old thought patterns and schemas, but like I said, I don't think this is new news. It's not as new as if we dig deep, we can see that this is actually consistent. And I also think there's a failure to consider the bigger picture. And there's a lot of case study potentially going on. And I'm going to go back to the judges. Why do judges think that women are always in their courtroom dropping the order, or that women lie? And I think part of it is that case study kind of memory bias, in that victims whose lives that they've changed, that they've saved, are not getting back on that court docket and going into that judge and saying, you know what, you saved my life. They're not calling the police back to say, you saved my life. Victim services tend to see victims in general where the systems failed them. So we've got all these agencies sort of talking about a subgroup. Meanwhile, the victims who are getting on with their life, who've got peace in their life, which is ultimately what they wanted, they've moved on, and they're not necessarily engaged with these other agencies or being represented. And I always like to talk about some success stories, and that we have to listen to all sides, not just the failures. And this is Kate's story. She was 19 when she fell in love with John. They lived in California initially. That's where they met and initially married. They were together for 5 years, and he was controlling and violent, but even still, she started college. He tried especially hard to sabotage her progress. He would do things like he would lock the refrigerator door so she couldn't eat during finals, but she went anyway. He would pour water on her as she was leaving before class, but she went to class anyway. They actually moved to Kentucky, and he told her when they got to Kentucky, it's going to be worse for you now because Kentucky's really backwards, and I can do whatever I want to you, and nobody's going to care at all. That's the way men treat women in Kentucky. So after she got here, she did find the courage to end the relationship. She couldn't find the courage to file for divorce, however. And for 3 years before we actually talked to her, he stalked, harassed, and interfered with her life. The final straw for her came one day when he threatened her dog, which I believe probably was her breaking point. And he also jeopardized her job that day. He called numerous times, came up there. So in spite of her fear, she did get that protective order. At the six-month follow-up, she told us she had not seen or heard from him since the protective order hearing, and she had actually been able to file for divorce, and that she felt safe and happy to be living in peace, and she was proud of her school accomplishments. And she felt like without that protective order and the other community support that she got, he would have continued to stalk her until she was seriously hurt or worse. So sort of the second argument we get about the data is, well, you know, there's something different about women who get protective orders, kind of like that bird hanging upside down on the telephone wire that's just different from all the others. I agree that women who obtain a protective order have to be very persistent. They have to be willing to face embarrassment. They have to be willing to risk safety. And they have to be a bit delusional to believe the justice system can actually help them. However, what we have to look at is, okay, well, how are they different? We don't really know how they're different, but here's what we do know. Not all victims of partner violence need or want a protective order. Not all of them even report to the police, so we have to keep that in mind. We don't have great data on the percent of women that do seek protective orders. What I can find is 30 to 40% do, but I'm not sure how accurate that is. We also know of those women who do obtain a protective order, there's a whole range of victimization experiences from frequency and severity and duration of the abuse. And we also know there's a group of victims who need or want a protective order but are never going to get one. So then the third argument I get from both academic colleagues, but also even practitioners have brought this up. Well, there's no random assignment, so how can you really know the differences were due to the protective order? And, you know, just my smart-ass response to that basically is, well, how many of us would jump out of a plane without a parachute? We did not randomly assign parachutes to see if they work or not. We just assume they're going to work. We know they're pretty effective based on observational data. But stepping back and thinking about that, I think that we have to look at the data. The results are very, very strong in this case. It's almost too strong to be coincidental. The results are robust and consistent with prior studies. They're robust across jurisdictions. And the other thing we see is a really nice linear relationship with offender behavior and outcomes, with the no violations, the violations, and the violations in stalking. But I agree, there is a black box. So what is it specifically about the protective order that impacts violence? I think we still have work to do. We know a lot more about who they are most effective for and under what circumstances, but we also know there are other factors that we certainly can work on to build on. Another argument. Okay, so I've been asked to wrap up in about 2 seconds. So let me just quickly go through this. So another argument I get is that stalking doesn't matter. And actually, stalking, of course, is my big pet peeve. It does matter. And however, what I do want to make clear is that of those stalking the victims that year before that protective order was issued, 2/3 stopped stalking from the protective order. So what we have is about 1/3 those persistent stalkers, and those are our most dangerous people we need to keep an eye on. So I'm going to skip through a lot of this. And finally, the last argument I get, well, this study was done in Kentucky. What does that have to do with us? And what I have to say to that is we in Kentucky, a group here, I wasn't involved, did a household survey that sort of replicated the National Violence Against Women survey questions and methodology. And what we found in Kentucky is we actually have higher rates of partner violence, about 1/3 versus 1 in 4. And also, you have to look at, not only did we look at these findings, but we went to very impoverished jurisdictions for a rural comparison. And when we look at Kentucky outcome data overall for the state, we are at the bottom of the barrel for health outcome indicators. So actually, I say if it can work in Kentucky, it can work anywhere. So that is sort of my wrap up. So hopefully we have some questions and I can get some feedback interaction.
Thank you, TK. I didn't mean to hurry you off too quickly. I just wanted to comment that. And we like those KFC logos.
I know.
Folks can either ask questions. You can take yourself off mute and ask some questions, or you can type into the box like Kelly did and ask a question that way if anyone has thoughts or comments. I know, you know, for example, comments on what might be surprising. There are a couple things I've seen TK present before, and yet, again, there were things that were surprising to me. So I don't know if other people have thoughts or questions. I'm going to call on people. Katie, are you still there? Do you have any questions? My attempt to be a school teacher are not working here. Oh, there it is. Katie, I was talking to you. Katie Strickfadden, yes.
Hello?
Hi.
Kelly
wanted to talk about...
Yeah? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, this is Katie Strickfadden. I'm sorry,
hi,
I didn't know if there was more than one Katie on the line.
No, just you.
To be honest with you, I'm a little overwhelmed by all the data.
Okay.
And as soon as you said that as being one of the reactions, I was like, me. That's me. That's what's happening to me right now. So, to be honest with you, if you give me a day or two, I might have some questions. But I'm just a little bit overwhelmed, and I don't tend to be good with data things, so it takes me a while.
Sure.
So I apologize. I don't have any questions. I'm sure I'll have a bunch, though.
Okay.
Sorry, I couldn't be more helpful.
No, that's fine. All right. Well, I want to say that I think it's really important for all of us as we're doing these projects to, as TK said, to like hear the good side of the story, that a lot of the protective orders and other things that we're doing actually are effective. So I won't say anything else, because Krista, I assume you want to give a chance for folks, you want to say some stuff and do a roll call or anything?
Just in closing, yeah, we only have about 7 minutes left. I'm not sure if we'll have time for a roll call. But I did want to go over a few things, but I can give you all, do you want to take like 4 more minutes and I can just take the last couple minutes to finish up?
Okay.
Hey, Liberty.
Yes?
This is Kelly.
Okay.
The reason I asked about the custody is because the biggest problem we're seeing in violations and repeat offenders is when there's custody involved. I'm one of those, I'm a little bit skeptical about the results of the study and if custody wasn't really dealt with. And that's sort of why I asked it. I was curious.
Well, as you saw, 48% of our petitioners had kids in common. Now, it wasn't dealt with in the necessarily in the EPO or the DVO. They is dealt with in family court. And all of our DVOs and EPOs are family court dockets right now. So it was dealt with, but it is rare that we see it dealt with in that context of a protective order. They require them to deal with that and child support and those and property and issues through other processes of the family court. Does that make sense? So we have domestic violence specific dockets.
Right, and we do,
Of course custody was dealt with and child support was dealt with. I'm just saying that the judges are not using the protective orders to do that, if that makes sense.
Right. So, and what we're having is, I guess, custody and child support are not, even though they should be handled in family court, they're not being handled in family court because of barriers in the justice system. And so our protective orders are kind of useless most of the time, because if they have custody issues, they're going to continue to have those custody issues, and they don't go file for custody in family court.
Well, that's why the judges don't want them to use the protective orders to deal with the custody issues. They're bifurcating sort of the violence issue and these other issues. So we took that into consideration. If you keep back in mind with our regression in terms of predicting violations, we looked at kids in common and all of that, and still our predictor was stalking. And the other thing I looked at is that 50% that did not experience a violation, if you remember, I said 50% of those women, so half of those who didn't experience a violation said they never even heard from him. So then I'm like, well, obviously those are women who didn't have children with him. So when I looked at that, children in common, actually there was no difference between those who said, I've not heard from him again, versus those who said, yeah, we've had contact, but he hasn't violated the order. So, you know, it's just, it's complicated. And like I said, I mean, this is a 213 women. We've got our other study, which was over 750 women in 12 months, and a large percent of them had kids in common. So
you didn't look at the ones that got actual custody orders out of family court and the ones that did not. Like, that wasn't a factor. Correct.
Well, they all would have gotten, if the custody was contested at all, they all would have gotten orders out of family court. If they had children in common, right.
So.
But in terms of, we did have some questions about child support is a big issue, too. So we had some questions about that, but we didn't do a kind of a separate analysis. We just took that into consideration with children in common.
Okay. Gotcha.
Into our regressions.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Hi, this is Chris O'Sullivan. It sounds perfectly plausible to me. We got similar data on 1,000 women and found the same thing. If they just didn't see them for one reason or another,
they didn't see
them. They were much safer. And whether they had children in common or not,
yeah,
didn't seem to affect that in a 9-month follow-up.
There you
Maybe
go.
The child issue wasn't coming up yet or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But we found the ones who returned to the relationship. Not that things happened. I don't know.
I won't say anything about it, but to me the most surprising thing was that the lack of enforcement didn't track with the violations. So in other words, in the rural areas, the fact that rural and urban women have the same reported rates of sort of continuing violence and effectiveness, but that didn't really track with the violations, enforcement on the violations. So in other words, lower level of arrest, et cetera.
Which is why potentially we see higher rates of fear, more distress and stress in the rural area as a whole and things like that, yeah.
But not higher re-victimization? Is that...
It was higher. Remember, on average, they had more violations. But when we just look at any violation, so 50% of women in the rural area did not experience a violation, and 50% of women in the urban area didn't. But, yes, so when you look at any violation, we see similar rates. But remember, in the one chart, and I know I presented a ton of data, and I talk really fast, and so there were 9. On average, the urban women experienced 9 violations on average in that 6-month follow-up versus 15 for the rural women. So that was sort of hitting my point. Like, not only is enforcement just sad. I mean, it's sad in both areas. I'm not trying to make the urban area look fabulous or anything like that, but it's super really not good at all in the rural area, especially given they're experiencing more violations.
Okay. Thank you, TK. I'm going to jump in here. This is Krista. We have 1 minute left, and this has been a really good presentation, TK. I really appreciate all the information that you were able to squeeze into our hour of time. No, this was an eye-opener for me. I had never seen or actually seen, you know, anyone actually calculate the cost benefits of the protection orders. That was particular interest here, and I'm sure it would be useful in some of our work. And I'm sure others may have more questions. Your information is there in the PowerPoint and also online, and you can, anyone can also follow it with the Center for Corporate Innovation through Liberty if they want to get questions to TK. So thank you.
Absolutely.
So much again. Yes.
Thank you.